Good morning. How's everyone doing? Doing all right? All right. It can be so hard to go to that place of not knowing. It can be so hard to go to that place of not knowing. For a couple of reasons. For one, we may not really believe that a place of not knowing is a good path for us. I mean, we may think, well, we're on this path. We're on the Zen path. We showed up for it. And now you're telling me there's no knowing. Doesn't that mean there's no path? We want knowing. We all want to know things. That may be why we started on this path in the first place. Life is hard. Life is confusing. Half the time, we don't know what to do. So we try different things that might provide some answers. We try science, or we try religion. We look to Buddhism. We think, well, maybe if I learn about Buddhism, I will know something about how the universe works, and I'll know what to do, and I'll know how to do it. We think, I should be able to do that, because the explanation must be in there somewhere. There's a book called Buddhist Cosmology. It explains how the universe is organized. There are the precepts, so we know how to act ethically. There's the Eightfold Path, so we know how to do the practice. So there must be some answers there. So what is this about no path and not knowing, which is especially emphasized in Zen, with its no eyes, no ears, no taste, no touch, no object of mind? It really can take a while, if we're new to Zen, to get that all of these teachings and principles are really intended to show that there are no teachings and there are no principles. There is instead not knowing. But what is this not knowing? Well, what I think is, certainty is impossible. From a really quiet place, we can surmise, not with logic, but with something deeper, that we cannot know the world, that all is mind, that we can only know what our mind is making of the world, or making up about the world. We can't know the world. We can't see it. We can only see our own mental activity. Is there an objective reality? I doubt it. But if there is, we can't know what that objective reality is. There's no certainty that the world is any certain way. The Buddha said, "All that we are is the result of what we have thought." So if we accept this, that we cannot know, then, well, it doesn't make much sense to live our lives in a way that is based on the fiction that things are knowable. Now, you may disagree with all of this, and you may think that things are knowable, and that's okay. But in our tradition, we have this kind of gift from the Buddhas and ancestors, which is the gift of not knowing. And it's not a revealed teaching. It's not something we simply accept. It's something we accept for ourselves with the guidance of the Buddhas and ancestors. They can help us get there. Mostly they point to the cushion, but they may also point to the garden or the vacuuming or the conversation we're in. You've probably heard the saying that not knowing is most intimate. Not knowing is most intimate. That means that the not knowing life is a vivid life, a life well lived because one is present for it. It is a life that is not restricted by the need to understand it all. It is a life of freedom here and now. If we're able to let go of that endless need for certainty, and knowing, and control over everything, then we can be open to everything. We can take it as it comes. And we are, I think it's safe to say, more happy. Not knowing is most happy. Sometimes. Sometimes not. But not knowing, I think, lets that real deep non-delusional happiness in. That's the happiness that's not based on fulfillment of desire. It's about being present in the moment without desire. It can be so hard to get to that place of not knowing. Even if we understand that it's a good path for us and we commit to it, we may find that that very commitment to the path is an attempt at a pathway. It assumes that there's a place and a place that can be gotten to. So already we're attempting to inject a kind of knowing into this not knowing process. And that makes it tricky. We have to constantly ask, is my commitment to practice, my devotion to practice, and my plan, is that just some new form of seeking certainty? Zen is anarchic. It constantly undermines everything. It says, no, it's not that. No, it's not that. And it's tricky. There is no pathway, and yet there is. Yes, there is not knowing. Yes, there is emptiness. And yet, there is a kind of knowing here in the world of form. We use our knowing to get to not knowing. It seems that if we give up the quest for knowing, if we give up that idea that we can get anything at all, if we give up the idea that we can know or have stuff, the inevitable result is a kind of human freedom. Does this mean that if we give up the need to get stuff, we somehow get stuff? This reminds me of the saying that Zen is Buddhism with jokes. It's a kind of joke. You don't get anything. You don't get anything. And if you just accept that, you will be at peace with the universe. You'll get that. So you can't really explain a joke, and if you do, you might just kill it, and it's not funny anymore. That little shock of illogical recognition is gone. But I can say about this joke that it has something to do with the nature of the you that I'm talking about and the nature of this desire to know. The you that desires to know is not exactly the same you that experiences this peace in the universe. When you accept not knowing, when you engage in that most intimate practice, when you get the joke, it's the larger you, which is connected to everything in the universe, and which encompasses the smaller you. So the freedom is not absence of you exactly, since the smaller you is still part of the deal. But you must experience absence of you, complete absence of you, to get to that new place where the smaller you is merely a part of the great, quieter freedom. So we can say that giving up on getting results is not a way to get something, but perhaps we can say that it's a kind of receiving. When you give up your quest, all the universe receives. And that includes the smaller you as well. And that's good. You must take care of the smaller you with its insecurities and its desires. So there's that. But what about this other thing, this other irony, that nothing can be known, and yet we do our very best to do things in the world in the right way? What we think is the right way, that we operate in the world in such a way that we are kind to others, that we help each other, we are responsible for our own selves, we reach out to do our best to end suffering and to promote joy. What is that? If there is no knowing, how can we know that that's the right thing to do? I've been trying to explain this to myself and to others for years, and I never really get any closer. I think it's another joke. It's unexplainable. But I do know that all the Buddhas and ancestors get to that same place. they get to that same place of kindness from that place of not knowing. And I can say this, if there is not knowing, and not knowing is most intimate, then we care for others as if their suffering were our own suffering. If we are most intimate, their suffering is our suffering. So that's my latest attempt to explain it, but you can't explain it. That's why we have koans. That's why we are so fond of stories that don't make any sense. They bring us to that place of no sense, and they leave us standing there, like we're standing at the edge of a deep well, or at the edge of a great canyon of dizzying height, and they leave us there, in a place that is most intimate. And that's the place we want to be. That's not training for going to another better place. That's the place. But it can be so hard to see with our small mind how it could be that giving things up is the way to happiness. But that's okay. It's all okay. You can embrace this mystery, and after it throws you around for a while, you'll give up your urge to solve it, and it will no longer be a disconcerting mystery. It will be thusness. It will be now. And it will be most intimate. Okay, so that was part one of this talk. And now I'm going to change the tone of this talk quite a bit. That's because I like to talk. I like to talk about not knowing. I also like to talk about how to open to not knowing, how to do it, how to do that, what the impediments are to doing that. So I like to offer a little bit of something for dear small mind. I love dear small mind. I love what makes us what we are and always has made us what we are and will never be extinguished. And I especially love small mind when it's not running amok. So I'm going to tell you a little story. And actually, I think it's kind of a funny story. It's kind of a joke. The joke's kind of on me in this story. And it has to do with Sonoma and with Rosemary. Is Rosemary here today? I don't think she is. Okay. Well, most of you know Rosemary. She's our sewing teacher, and she's a priest here, and she's been my friend for many years. And I want you to know that I warned her I'd be telling this story about her, because I don't like to ambush anyone in any way. And she was okay with it. So, as some of you know, I spent 30 days one summer at Sonoma Zen Mountain Monastery in California. And some of you know that because I've talked about it a lot. It was a very vivid and rich experience, and I come back to it a lot. So, of that 30 days, a week of it was a sesshin. And if you've done sesshins, that is, formal retreats, you know that the schedule is very tight. There's hardly any time to do anything personal, and you never get to indulge in a lot of sleep. And we had that daily choice there, which Rosemary actually remembered from having stayed at Sonoma a few years earlier, between you either get to take a shower or you get a snack to supplement your oryoki meals. You don't get both. And I chose a shower, and I lost weight over the course of the 30 days. But the other 3 weeks were also pretty intense. It was an ongo, so very limited talking, a lot of sitting, a lot of work practice, and again, not a lot of sleep. And so after a while, the whole thing was kind of wearing me down a little bit. My one indulgence was that I would call my wife Kathy every day. But I didn't do any writing. I didn't have any amenities. It was all pretty Spartan. And then one day, someone said to me, "You've got a package in the Sangha house." And I said, "A package? In the Sangha house? A package? What could this be?" And right away, I'm thinking, in my kind of deprived state, I'll bet this is something good. Now, Big Mind was doing pretty well at this retreat, with all of that meditation and mindful work and everything. But Small Mind was starting to think it wasn't getting a very good deal here. And it was building up kind of a bit of a resentment. It wanted a shower and a snack, and it wanted a few days off. So I went in, I got the package, and it was about 8 inches square, and I looked at the return address, and it was from Rosemary, and I thought, wow, it's from Rosemary. It's from home. I'll bet it's a care package. I bet there's some really nice stuff in there, because that's the kind of thing Rosemary would do. I bet there's some chocolate in there. Rosemary knows I like chocolate. There was that time she gave me a piece of chocolate during a session. So small mind is starting to run amok. So with small mind running amok, I opened this package and I found some pieces of brown cloth. And then I found some more pieces of brown cloth and a little ruler and some needles and some thread and a seam ripper and some instructions and a note that said, "This is so you can get started sewing your brown robe." And I was like, she sent me work. She sent me work to do in my spare time at my Ango. So what could I do? Well, of course, being a good Zen student, I started sewing in my spare time at the Ango, I think that very day. And the next day, when I talked to Kathy on the phone, I gave her precise instructions about mailing me 3 bars of dark chocolate to the Sangha house. So then a few days later, the chocolate arrived, and I got to reflect on its kind of addictive quality and how, with sensual desires, there's never, ever any real calm or quiet. There's only this constantly renewing cycle of desire, temporary fulfillment of desire, and then more desire. You eat some chocolate, and you want some more. And so I reflected on those things. I also really enjoyed the chocolate. And the sewing went well. I was able to approach it with a pretty quiet mind, and I came to that intimate place of not knowing, because sewing is a great activity for that. And some people helped me, which was great. I have quite a few Sonoma stitches in my brown robe. And I really appreciate, I think that I'd like to say I was able to hold myself to a high standard, but I have to say Rosemary was able to hold me to a high standard during those 30 days, and I really appreciate that. And Rosemary, if you listen to this talk on the website, I want you to know I'm infinitely grateful to you for all the sewing you've helped me with over the years. And I really do appreciate that you sent that sewing to me so I could get started. And next time, just throw in a little chocolate, okay? So the point of that story is pretty simple. It's about how to relate to small mind. Small mind is okay. Small mind is like a little child that we love. Small mind is needy. It has a lot of needs, and one thing it needs is it needs to know. Small mind wants to know. It has desires, and it wants those desires fulfilled. And how do we deal with small mind? The same way we deal with a small child. If you've heard me talk before, you probably know that I emphasize kindness and gentleness in the practice. Now, it's possible to pursue the Zen route in a super disciplined way and try to control small mind, and it may appear sometimes that Zen practice is set up for that. It can be pretty rigorous. But my theory has always been that within that rigorous container, we can be very, very kind to small mind. We know small mind is there, and we love it too, and we give it its due, but we try not to let it run the show so much of the time. We accept, forgive, and love our faults in the way that we accept, forgive, and love the faults of the people in our lives whom we love the most. So, I asked Kath for some chocolate. I enjoyed it. And I have no shame about that. And although I have a great respect for Zen rules, I believe that Zen rules, except for the ethical rules, are made to be broken. Because remember, we don't want to inject a kind of knowing into the not knowing process. If we pursue this practice with an open heart, we will cultivate that which is affirming, the big mind, the not knowing mind. So we don't really have to push the part that is not affirming away. When something negative arises, greed, anger, or self-delusion, we don't need to say, that's bad and I need to get rid of it. We can say, oh, I see that. I see that. And in seeing it, we move to big mind in this very moment. It's that simple. Here, right now, is the reality of small mind. I see it without judgment or plan, and then I'm wholly in that moment. And no trace is left. And then the next moment comes, and that is? Well, that's a big question mark, isn't it? And now part three. I think I've been listening to This American Life too much. Part three, koan. So I'm going to change my tone again a little bit, and I'm going to take a brief look at a koan. It's case 27 from the Gateless Barrier, non-chuan, not mind, not Buddha, not beings. It's on your program. If you picked up a program, you can follow along. And this is Robert Aitken's translation that I'm using. So, the case. A monk asked Nan Chuan, is there a fundamental truth that has never been expounded for people? Nan Chuan said, there is. The monk said, what is the fundamental truth that has never been expounded for people? Nan Chuan said, it is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not beings. Wu Men's comment. At the question, Nan Chuan used up all his personal treasure immediately and became quite debilitated. Wu Men's verse. Scrupulous care dissipates your virtue. No words truly have an effect. Though the great ocean becomes a field, it cannot be communicated to you. So I think that one way to read this is as an admonishment of a Zen teacher who gets it wrong, who becomes quite debilitated. As soon as Nan Chuan answers that question, is there a fundamental truth that has never been expounded for people, by saying there is, he is saying, yes, there is a fundamental truth. He is expressing a kind of certainty that we might not ordinarily associate with an advanced teacher. And then ask, what is this fundamental truth? Nan Chuan has to backpedal a little. He says, it is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not beings. He can't say what it is, he can only say what it isn't. He's probably thinking to himself, I hope this monk does not ask a follow-up question, because I'm digging myself in pretty deep here. And then Wu Men's comment, he used up all of his personal treasure, and he became quite debilitated. Wu Men appears to be quite critical. He's saying that Nan Chuan blew it. And another translation by Katsuki Sakita says that Nan Chuan was not a little confused. And in Wu Men's verse, he could be saying that Nan Chuan said too much and tried to communicate what could not be communicated. So, if we follow this interpretation, that Nan Chuan blew it, it's kind of an unusual case. We have a monk, you know, quote, a monk, end quote, who comes to Nan Chuan, who is not even named, so it looks like Nan Chuan is the teacher, and usually in these stories, the teacher says something brilliant and the student becomes enlightened, but here we have the possibility that the teacher is wrong. And Aitken agrees that we can take this approach, saying that Wu Men is being rather critical of Nan Chuan, and Aitken says, that Nan Chuan is expounding at a rather intellectual level and trying to sum up everything in a discursive way. He says, we can reserve judgment on the young Nan Chuan and be thankful that he went on to deepen his realization. And Sakita says the verse, which he translates as, talking too much spoils your virtue, can be read to mean that Nan Chuan himself talked too much and spoiled his own virtue. And that reading, I think, fits rather neatly with my theme about not knowing. Once you say that there is a fundamental truth, you're done for. But of course, that's not the only way to read this case, and it would be going against the spirit of my talk if I tried to wrap things up that neatly. So I would like to suggest that there is another way to read this, and that is Nan Chuan really is a capable master here. We could say that Nan Chuan is using words in kind of an ironic way, as if to say the fundamental truth is that there is no fundamental truth. We can say that it's a kind of wordplay that may help us to see something deeper than this any logical inconsistency. And under this reading, Nan Chuan is saying that the fundamental truth has never been expounded because it can't be expounded. And that's from Sakita. You can't explain it. You can only experience it. But the monk doesn't get that at all, and he just asks, well, what is this truth? And in saying it is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not beings, Nan Chuan is reminding the monk that whatever you think it is, that's not what it is. And then, under that reading, using up his personal treasure immediately is not a bad thing. It is leaving no trace through speaking the truth freshly and intimately. So Robert Aitken says he became quite debilitated, and Sakita says he was not a little confused, and both of those do sound pretty critical, but maybe that's a positive thing. Maybe that's not knowing. Maybe their translations are a little ironic then. And then finally, the verse can be read to praise Nan Chuan for the few words he used, as opposed to saying that he said too much. But what I'd like to leave you with is Sakita's comment that what Nan Chuan is doing here is exhorting you to make the effort yourself. Though the great ocean becomes a field, it cannot be communicated to you. Though the stars fall and the sun rises in the west, it cannot be communicated to you. No one can give it to you. And also, I'd just like to say that this case, no matter how you read it, is pretty gentle. If Nan Chuan is being criticized, he's being criticized in a pretty kind way. And if the monk is being criticized, that's being done pretty kindly as well. No one gets whacked in this koan, which is nice. And I think it fits my theme today, which is, I invite you to keep your mind open, to not know, and to do this with gentleness, being ever so kind to yourself, approaching practice from the positive side of opening big mind rather than fighting small mind. Only don't know. Only don't know, and that is most intimate. And that's my talk. And I would like to invite comments or perhaps questions.
Tim?
Yes, Bill.
In the beginning of your talk, you mentioned a book about Buddhist cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
Is that canonical or is that a modern book?
It's a modern book. I took a course once, a college course in Buddhist cosmology, and that was the text. And it was fascinating. You'd like it. I should lend it to you. I did, in Buddhist cosmology. Mm-hmm. It was fascinating. I remember Seas of Butter. Yeah. And, was there someone else? Yes, Chris.
So would you say that not knowing is somehow analogous to non-duality, and knowing to duality of the absolute and the relative?
I would say that.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks.
And I think somebody just needs to say the words Heisenberg uncertainty principle to go with this.
Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Okay. Thanks. Okay, well, that was a... Okay, all right. Yes, Jeff. And then Benton.
Okay. So, I've been coming to the Zen Center for 10 years. For 10 years before that, I've been involved in a regular Zen practice. Actually, starting 45 years ago, I first stepped into a Zendo. Gautama Siddhartha was a male born into an upper caste Indian family, apparently. In all my contact with Buddhism, I have never seen a teacher of Buddhism open themselves up to the teachings of Audre Lorde, Ella Baker, Angela Davis, Winona LaDuke. I am disturbed by that.
Well, those are certainly teachers who are worth studying. Thank you. Thank you. And Benton.
So I've heard often said that Buddhism and Zen cannot be expressed in words. Librarian and caretaker of 2,000 books. I'm sure you people keep trying.
Did you say you want to make sure people?
Yes.
Keep trying. Yes. Yeah. Well, those books, they have their place. They have their place. Yes, they do. They're a valuable resource. Yes.
I would like to make a comment. When Bodhidharma uses the term not knowing, he's attempting to point directly to our essential nature, the one thing that can't be described in words.
Mm-hmm.
All the great masters seem to agree on that, that it can't be described.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean you can't experience it directly. But then the challenge becomes is that if you do manage to open up or to awaken and experience it directly, you still can't tell what it is, and you still don't know what it is. So you're stuck in that not knowing.
Well said. Well said. You're stuck in that not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Benton.
One of the books that we're reading together right now is Katagiri's book, You Have to Say Something. So even though you can't express it in words, you have to try.
You have to try. And words can help. You know, words cannot substitute for direct experience, but they can be guides.
And my experience has been that my attempt to talk about it, even if I don't get through to the other person, I probably won't, fits through to my own heart. My working on talking it through gets it clear in my own mind, in my own heart.
Yeah. We're not really dissing words here, although sometimes they get so tiresome. And sometimes simple activity is so welcome. After a day of words, I love to sweep. Or before a day of words. All right, well, thank you, everyone.